Are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Or do we need, like some people, letters of recommendation to you or from you? You yourselves are our letter, written on our hearts, known and read by everyone. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Such confidence we have through Christ before God. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. He has made us competent as ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life.
Please be seated, and before kids take off, before Ike leaves, we just got back from, lots of folks got back from camp. I'm just curious, who all went to camp this week? If you were at camp, stand up. I want to see campers, and I want to see people like the Coopers. Wonderful. Did you guys have a good time? Let's acknowledge the blessing of camp this morning. Thank you, Ike. Yes. I know good things happened at camp this week, and there's more good things happening for our first through sixth graders, and you guys can go find out from Mr. Ike what that is right now. That's great. What a blessing for our kids to spend time with the seasoned people and the people, folks here at North Lake who love and care for our children deeply. Great blessing. Well, letters. What we write down can distort and deceive. It is possible to do that. We heard this business about letters in this text. Probably the most notable exception about the capacity to deceive through written material comes from April of 2007, about 5 or 6 years ago, when the Dean of Admissions at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology resigned that year, Marilee Jones, after it came to light that 28 years prior to that time, she had falsified her CV, her resume, saying that she'd gone to several colleges and universities, but she hadn't done any of that at all. And she had risen through MIT's Department of Admissions to be the dean, while only having just a year or two of college under her belt. The irony of this, of course, is that she was one who was teaching people how to write resumes and begging students as they would apply for admission to MIT to not pad your resume. And so this idea of what we put down on paper can at times distort or maybe not tell the true truth, the full truth about a person. Paul writes here in these words, we're hearing only a half of a bit of a conversation. We hear the questions come out. Are you asking now for me to submit a letter of recommendation about myself to you, church? He's asking the Corinthian people. They were, it appears that folks had come into Corinth saying, well, you know, you've been listening to Paul, but Paul's not the real deal. He's not really an apostle. And by the way, did he bring any letters of recommendation when he came to preach for you? And you can see these Corinthian congregational members kind of scratching their heads saying, well, you know, come to think of it, I don't think he did submit any kind of references or letters of recommendation or any such sort of thing. And off they go to the races with this. Paul is writing to say, what makes for authentic Christianity? Is it just someone writing a letter that authenticates faith? Or is it something else that is at stake in all of this? Now, I find this to be an interesting question in a number of ways, but primarily because I think there may be times in our own life when we might get to thinking that what makes us authentically Christian are things that are written down. You know, like, is your name written down in the North Lake Church directory of family and friends or not? Does that make you authentically Christian? Is your name on a baptism letter someplace? Does that make you authentically, truly Christian or not? Or the fact that you show up to church regularly, does that make you authentically Christian or not? The tendency can be for us to think that our authenticness, our realness, our life with God is defined by what is written down, or even by what we say we believe, rather than how we actually behave. And here in this text, we're working with something very, very critical, and I apologize if I'm going to use a couple of big words, but hang on with me here. We can wrestle with and think that it's about having orthodoxy, correct sorts of belief, rather than, here's the other big word, orthopraxy, that is the practice of what is real and true. Again, what we say we believe and instead what we really do. And at the heart of this, it seems to me, is understanding what does it mean to be authentically a Christian? What does it really take? Is it jumping through hoops, or is it something else altogether? That's why Paul will argue this out with them in this text in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, here looking at verse 1 and following. As Lori read it there for us a moment ago, you hear the rhetorical questions, we've noted that. And Paul's response to this church is to say, what do you mean asking me for letters of recommendation? You are my letter of recommendation. The very fact that you have come to faith out of the practices of my preaching and teaching and my life among you, you are the living demonstration of the truthfulness, the authenticity of my ministry, my life. You yourselves are our letter, written on our hearts to be known and read by all, to show that you are a letter of Christ. And here he's moving from the idea of papers and documents and other such things to looking into the human heart and seeing what is written there. Is Christ present in your heart and life? Is the Spirit of the living God, this language here, where we've been written on as a letter of Christ, written not with ink, not with ink and typed out neatly in a 12-point font, but rather by the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Is being laid out here is the possibility that what makes us authentically real and authentically connected and alive to the presence of God is not stuff or doing things or what's written down someplace, but what actually exists within our very being. It's a challenge for us with this. We sometimes want to swing back over to orthodoxy, to correct sorts of belief, how we believe things ought to be, to make us think that we're authentically in touch with God, rather than understanding that it's really about our practice, what is being lived out in our lives. It's been a challenge for years. Back in 1837, that's a little before most of us were around, although I sometimes wonder about Aaron a little bit. He's looking a little gray there. 1837, a man by the name of Alexander Campbell, who was part of the heritage of the Stone and Campbell churches, a leader among those churches, received a letter from a woman who wrote and said, "Now, I've been hearing you say some things about baptism, She says, I get the impression that you're saying that it's not about being baptized that makes a person Christian, but really about life. How could this be? And Campbell has to explore that with her. And he makes a rather remarkable point. He makes the point that the real demonstration of the presence of the Spirit of God in a person is not whether or not they've been wet or not, but rather in the vitality of their life. And that is what Paul is encouraging here, and it's what I want for you to consider in your life. Is the Spirit of the living God at work in you? And in what ways is that happening in your life? Now, Paul continues almost seamlessly here in these verses to press with another set of images that I want us to consider. He uses now, perhaps for the first time, the language of minister. He says, we're ministers of a new covenant, he says. Ministers of a covenant, a new covenant. Now, this word minister is an important word for Paul. He uses it about 36 times in the core of his material. The word minister shows up 20 times in 2 Corinthians alone. It's a big thing for him to talk about minister. And I want to take a minute to talk about the word because we get confabulated about it a lot because we, in our English translations, have a lot of words that translates the one word minister. The word in Greek, I'm really going at it now, aren't I? You got it ready for a Greek word? Diakonos. You've heard this word. Many of you have. Diakonos. I use the word because it sometimes gets translated deacon. Sometimes, in some of our translations, it's translated deaconess. And sometimes it's translated the word servant. Sometimes it's translated the word minister or ministry. Now, do you begin to see why it gets a little confusing? It gets used and used three or four different ways. And so we can easily begin to think that if a person is a deacon in a church, that that's different than being the minister in the church. And yet we all say that we're all ministers. And on it goes. It gets a little confusing. In fact, it can be kind of debilitating for us if we don't understand that what Paul is talking about here, being a minister of the new covenant, as he talks about his own identity, that it's not something that he exclusively holds. It's something that he simply is following out in his life. To be the minister of the new covenant is Paul's way of saying, this is what I live for. It's what I serve. It's what I do. It's the same kind of thing that Jesus will say in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, no one can serve what, church? Two masters. You're going to love one and hate the other? Are you going to despise the one and be devoted to the other? No one can serve both God and mammon. Now, you see, the thing is that you're going to serve something. There is something you're going to be devoted to. There's something you're going to give yourself over to. It may be yourself. And for a lot of us, that's what we serve. In fact, that's the primary move as a human being, is it not? To take care of self. To sell of ourselves. But Paul is saying, no, I've been called, we've been called, to be servants, to serve, to give ourselves over to something else, to the new covenant. To the new covenant. Well, I wish we could kind of get beyond some of the problems we have with this word minister or servant or deacon. I served on a panel this past week at the Christian Scholars Conference. It was held in Nashville, Tennessee this past week. I was on a panel with ministers. There was seven of us on the panel. And sitting immediately to my left, I had the opportunity to meet for the first time someone, Patrick, you know very well, David Jones, who is the minister for the Schrader Lane Church of Christ in Nashville, Tennessee, a leading congregation in Nashville, a black Church of Christ, 1,200 to 1,500 members. They have literally about 70 to 80 different ministries and programs going on in the community where they employ about that many people within the church. A payroll of about 80 people serving in the community. Remarkable, remarkable ministry of that church. We talked about a lot of things on the panel, but afterward, David and I got into a conversation, and he made the remarkable comment that says, one of the things that hold us up so much in churches of Christ is that we get all hung up on elders and deacons and ministers and all these other titles, and we think somehow or another that there is some sort of pattern in the New Testament that says this is the way it has to be without looking and asking the question, what is God doing in our world, and how do we proclaim Jesus Christ in this world? And let then our patterns of ministry follow that. Wow, that's good. It's very good. Now, what I want to say here on this point is that you and I are called to serve. We're called to be ministers of what's he call it here? Covenant. A covenant. That we've been given the opportunity to participate, to give ourselves over to a new covenant. Well, what's the new covenant? What is it that we're given over to? What does that look like, this new covenant? Well, the most important thing that could be said about this new covenant is that it's a gift. It's something that's given to us. It's a promise that God has given to us. It's a promise of God's faithfulness to us. It's a gift of the promise of God to be faithful to us through Jesus Christ. In other words, what it is that we've been called over to live out is not something that we do for ourselves, but we do it in service of what God has done through His promise. Again, our challenge as human beings is to live for ourselves, to exert ourselves, to claim for ourselves what we think is good and right and important. And here Paul is saying, no, the very, very heart of our life and faith is this, that we have been given a great gift and we've been called on to live in service of that great gift. That is to say, the promise of God's covenant faithfulness to us in Jesus Christ. That's what we bear. That's what we carry. That's what we live out. It's what we embody. And when we embody that covenant, when we embody the self-sacrificing love of Jesus Christ in our lives, in our words, in our deeds, by our orthopraxy, by the practice of our lives, the practice of our faith, then something remarkable occurs. The Spirit of the living God comes to life within us and comes to the life within others. And we don't need to worry about whether or not our name is on a piece of paper. We don't need to worry about whether or not we've got the proper letters of recommendation to validate our place in the world. We don't need to have others come along and say, attaboy, you're doing good. Because what we're living out is the truth of what it is that God has done in Jesus Christ, and it's showing up in our own lives, day by day, moment by moment. And when that happens, wonderful and remarkable things happen. Transformation occurs when Jesus Christ is alive in us. Now, I know that it can be difficult. I know that the tendency is to revert back to rules and regulations. I know the tendency is to place importance upon what we can write down and nail down and figure it all out. I know that we all have expectations about what we want for ourselves, and we often find ourselves being disappointed by what life gives to us. We think that we can chart out our course, our career, our life, the way our family will look, what we're going to do in the world, and all of that. But what would happen? What would happen if we could finally relinquish all those things and accept and embrace the idea of being servants of the covenant? that we give ourselves over wholly to bearing out in our words and our deeds and our life the gift of God in our life with others. You know, when I think about this idea of Paul saying to that church, you are our letters of recommendation, because in your life we can see the blessing of the message that I brought to you. A film comes to mind. I'd like to remind you of that film as we close this sermon this morning. I believe it was in 1996. Richard Dreyfuss starred in a movie film called Mr. Holland's Opus. Remember it? It's a great film. Probably worth going back and finding it on Netflix and watching it again in light of what I'm trying to say today. Glenn Holland, the character played by Richard Dreyfuss, is a musician. He's bright. He's articulate. He's got a great future in front of him, and yet, for by various reasons, decides to step aside for a little while and become a local band teacher in a local high school, just for a little while until he can get himself squared away so he can write a great symphony, a great orchestral piece. But one thing leads to another, and that never happens for him. He ends up being the band director in an ordinary school with all the ordinary politics. The football coach gets all the acclaim, not the band director. The assistant principal hates his guts. He deals with all the frustrations of that. He races home every day to try to write on his opus, only to be defeated by all the demands of all those students. And to top it all off, as you can see him being pounded into the earth by life's circumstances, his one hope that perhaps he could pass on the love of music to his own son gets dashed on the rocks when he discovered that his son, his one child, is deaf and can't hear anything. He retreats further and further. And so his whole career gets played out 30 years in this ordinary high school doing ordinary things, thinking, feeling as if nothing really mattered. And yet, in the midst of all of that, one thing that Glenn Holland did was call for excellence in those students. He challenged them to be competent. He challenged them to pursue. He pressed and pressed. He pressed for money for the arts. He did all he could do at every turn, at every turn. And yet at the end of it all, that vice principal that hated his guts came to be principal and finally got the whole program canceled and got him fired at age 60. Utter bitterness. Until, as he retired and went back to the classroom to pick up his last belongings one Saturday morning, as he walked out with his box of stuff, he heard a little bit of commotion in the auditorium. And there, walking into the auditorium, were all of his past students for 30 years gathered there. And a band up on the stage, playing music, amazed. Here are all these people that had been a part of his past for 30 long years there, present. His wife delays on the podium until the governor of the state could show up to speak at this grand retirement celebration, surprised to Glenn Holland. And the governor gets up and makes a little speech. And it's this speech in particular that speaks to what I think needs to be heard today. He says this, or she says this, the governor of the state of Oregon: Mr. Holland had a profound influence on my life and a lot of lives, I know, and yet I get the feeling that he considers a great part of his life misspent. Rumor had it that he was always working on this symphony of his, and it was going to make him rich and famous, and probably both. But Mr. Holland isn't rich and he isn't famous, at least not outside our little town. So it might be easy for him to think of himself as a failure, but he'd be wrong, because I think he's achieved a success far above riches and fame. And then she turns and looks at Mr. Holland and gestures with a sweeping hand across the auditorium and across the stage filled with all of his past students, and says to Mr. Holland, look around you. There is not a life in this room that you have not touched, and each one of us is a better person because of you. We are your symphony, Mr. Holland. We are the melodies and the notes of your opus, and we are the music of your life. Authentic ministry, serving the new covenant, living out the life of the Spirit, may not look rich or glamorous, but it is the call that Paul offers to us. And don't you doubt for a moment the value and the significance that each one of you have in the lives of people around you, past, present, and future. Because of the living Christ within us, God is at work writing out letters of recommendation in your life and in mine.